Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Unless you have a medical condition that prohibits it, a Tylenol is a popular way to lower a fever or relieve a headache. In fact, 52 million Americans take acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol, each week. But new research out of Ohio State University shows that acetaminophen may also dull emotional pain. It's the first time this side effect has been documented in the drug's 70-year history. Joining us now are two of the study's authors, doctoral candidate in psychology at Ohio State, Jeff Durso. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And also assistant professor of psychology at OSU and the Wexner Center Institute for Behavioral Medicine Research, Baldwin Way. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
What made you decide to do a study like this? When did it occur to you that this might have an effect at all?
So there's been some recent research showing, actually, that, as you mentioned, acetaminophen, the active ingredient Tylenol, might have effects on people's psychology and their well-being beyond what they experience from physical pain. And some of that research, the first one, was about how it seems to reduce social pain over time. So in that study, by some other authors than ourselves, they ran a three-week regimen of people taking acetaminophen, and they found, compared to those who took a placebo instead, they reported fewer hurt feelings over time. And so they referred to that as a sort of like, well, it must be that it's reducing social pain in addition to physical pain. Our approach was to investigate a bit further why that might be the case. And so our research was interested in finding maybe acetaminophen is actually reducing emotionality more generally, and that's what's explaining the effect.
And what did you find?
Well, what we found was that when we present people with these stimuli in the laboratory setting, we give them an acute dose in our study, as it turns out, not over time of 3 weeks. So we invite people into the lab, and when we make people experience these emotions, we present them with stimuli that are highly negative and extreme, or they could be highly positive and also extreme. And what we found was that acetaminophen was blunting emotions regardless if they were negative or positive. So in our research, it seems that acetaminophen is acting to, in part, reduce pain, be it physical or social, because it's reducing the extent to which people are experiencing emotions more generally.
And emotions affect how we experience pain, Baldwin Way?
Yes, emotions are a key component of pain. They also are a key component of our regular, everyday social interactions, whether it be hearing a compliment from your spouse or a snide remark from your spouse. So we think that acetaminophen has long been known to have effects in the brain. That seems to be where it reduces pain. It doesn't seem to act in the periphery at the site of the or source of pain. It seems to act in the brain. So if it's acting in the brain, it would seem to make sense that it's affecting a variety of psychological functions that are, of course, processed in the brain.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a side effect of acetaminophen that's being discovered now and recent research at Ohio State University. My guests are Baldwin Way, he's a professor of psychology at OSU, and also Jeff Durso. He is a doctoral candidate at OSU in psychology. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So I guess the question is, does a stub toe hurt more when you're in a bad mood than when you're in at least a dulled mood?
Interesting. I'm not so sure.
When you
sure.
bang your head on the car door when you're irritated about something, does it hurt more than when you don't?
I don't have a ready answer for that. I think it would depend on just what you're expecting to happen in your environment. So if you're in a bad mood, you might expect things to go badly, like, oh, of course I would stub my toe. And then you're kind of using that, and that could maybe even increase the pain that you experience because it's just compounding and it's adding to this negativity that you have. But I can imagine it would also potentially decrease your pain because it's if it's expected, it has less of an impact on you depending on what is going on in your environment.
I think that's one of the frontiers of pharmacological research right now is trying to figure out how one's present psychological state changes the effects of a drug. We can think of our psychological state is a shift in the chemicals in our brain, the neurotransmitters in our brain shift with each passing mood or experience we have. And as those shift, presumably a drug such as acetaminophen or other drugs that we commonly take will interface differently with those neurotransmitter systems, those neurochemical pathways, and have potentially different effects. It's something that really hasn't been studied much. People have generally just viewed you take a drug and it has this effect.
Mm-hmm.
But we're starting to see more and more effects of how one's psychology or present emotional state can change the effects of a drug. So that's kind of where things need to go in the future.
So is this officially a side effect of acetaminophen?
Side effect is that's a difficult question. It's certainly an effect that we didn't understand beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I think I think this is probably more common than we think with many drugs. One of the things that's happened over the last 20, 30 years, for example, is that people have begun to understand more about the immune system. The immune system was originally thought not to influence the brain, and that has really come to an end by a lot of actually some key work done here at Ohio State and the Institute for Behavioral Medicine Research on inflammation. Definitely seems to have brain effects. And so many drugs that are probably affecting peripheral processes are also probably affecting central processes. So by that, I mean brain processes or psychology processes.
This is not to say that people should start taking acetaminophen or Tylenol on a regular basis to achieve what you found in your study. Acetaminophen is not good to take all the time, right?
Correct.
Correct. Acetaminophen at higher doses does have toxic effects on the liver. There's reactive oxygen species. Anyway, toxic products that can damage your liver. So when you take it regularly or at high doses, it is problematic.
And then I suppose a lot of people are wondering, well, a lot of people who can't take take acetaminophen who use ibuprofen instead. I'm having a brain I just can't think of the name of the drug, the popular drug that uses ibuprofen.
Advil,
right. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, well, does that do the same thing? Would that do the same thing? Do we know?
We don't know. That's an area we're interested in exploring. Traditionally, ibuprofen, aspirin, that is a general class of drugs referred to as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs for short. And drugs like ibuprofen and aspirin are well known to have anti-inflammatory effects as well as pain-inhibiting and fever-inhibiting effects, whereas acetaminophen has traditionally been only thought to have pain effects and fever-inhibiting effects,
right,
but not thought to have anti-inflammatory effects. So acetaminophen is thought to be in a different category. We wonder if acetaminophen might actually be inhibiting inflammation in the brain. That's not traditionally or conventionally thought, but and if that is how acetaminophen is exerting these emotional effects, we think that it might be having very similar effects to ibuprofen. And so that is something we hope to explore in the future, is do aspirin and ibuprofen and these classes of drugs also affect common psychological processes such as emotional reactivity?
Right. I mean, the interesting thing that we've talked about already was all emotions were blunted, not just negative ones. But this is the experience of a lot of people who take antidepressants and take a whole raft of different kinds of drugs. So it may be just sort of an all-around blunting mechanism that you're trying to isolate?
Absolutely. That's been sort of the ongoing theory that we're using to understand some of the, as Baldwin mentioned, the drug interactions with the person and their environment. Instead of a drug having just a very specific negative blunting effect, we suspect a lot of these drugs might be blunting kind of anything that people are thinking about in their environment at the time. So if that is a negative emotion, it would blunt that. But if it was a positive emotion, we suspect a lot of these drugs meant to blunt just negatives would blunt the positives as well.
How do you start to suss out what it is in the drug, what property is doing that?
That's a challenging question. It's particularly challenging in human studies. In animal studies, you can use a broader array of techniques to get at what we call the mechanism, the biochemical pathway by which it's acting. In humans, we have to draw on the animal literature and do the best we can with our methods. But one example would be, for example, if we think acetaminophen is inhibiting inflammatory processes in the brain, immune system signaling processes in the brain, if we give ibuprofen, which is known to do that, and they show similar behavioral effects, one might then start to conclude that, oh, if ibuprofen and acetaminophen are having same psychological and behavioral effects, maybe they're acting via the same pathways. It's just a hypothesis at this point, but that is how we would go about trying to tease apart or identify which processes and which neurochemical signaling pathways are involved in how acetaminophen or ibuprofen act.
So is that what's next? You'll do the similar study on ibuprofen?
Yes, to disclose our future upcoming results.
You'll
hopefully,
have to screen out, do you listen to All Sides with the Unfisher
yes.
on Wednesday?
Yes.
So that is, I'd say, big half of what we were interested in as well. And then the second half is kind of understanding even more of the consequences of this blunting action. So if that is the kind of front end where we want to understand, okay, it's blunting emotions, why is it doing that? The other side of that is, okay, it's blunting emotions. What else is that going to what is that going to result in for people? And we're finding a lot of things in the lab from other students that work with Baldwin here that are finding all sorts of things, and in particular with regards to acetaminophen. So there will be further results to be talked about soon, hopefully.
How did you, in the study, bring about the social pain you talked about? What did you do? Did you insult people? Did you make fun of their
Not
hair?
In this study.
So in previous studies on that, the first one, in fact, that was by a professor named Nathan DeWall at the University of Kentucky. He had people actually just do a diary and would record the extent to which they had felt socially rejected or hurt their feeling, had their feelings hurt around other people over the span of a few weeks. And in our study, what we employed was a set of photographs that have been used for decades reliably by psychologists to elicit emotions relatively quickly and reliably in a laboratory setting. And so in the negative sense, if we wanted people to experience a negative emotion, an extreme one, we'd show them these extremely unpleasant photographs of, for example, crying, malnourished children, a disgusting overflowing toilet, those sorts of things. Okay. On the other hand, we had them look at also extremely pleasant photographs at times, and those would be, you know, kids in a sunny day in a park playing with kittens, a large pile of money, zooming in on a couple in bed together, those sorts of things that elicit, like, oh, that's really nice, that's positive to me. And so that's how we reliably induce these emotional states in people in the laboratory in order to study it.
There was an interesting finding in a follow-up study you did on all of this. Participants reported how much of the color blue they saw in each photo. What does that tell you?
It's a great question. So in our studies, it seemed that everything we studied with regards to the photos, be it the evaluation, how negative or positive, be it how emotionally arousing this is, be it negative or positive, everything was blunted. So in our minds, we needed to be a bit more specific, we thought. We needed to say, okay, is it just blunting everything? Is this just kind of like making them less attentive? Are they taking the study less seriously, maybe? We have no idea. So we threw another measure in there that was, okay, we think this is about kind of like evaluations and emotions. So what's a measure of these photographs that people could report that wouldn't be at all related to the emotional aspects of the photo? And so we looked at, okay, photographs are colorful. Let's get them to focus on one of these colors, and maybe that will potentially be blunted too. It would have been interesting if that had happened, because then we would have had a very different understanding of what's going on. But it turned out that acetaminophen was blunting specifically the negative and positive emotions that people were experiencing and evaluating about these photographs, and it had no effect on these relatively less emotional judgments people made. So the blueness ratings, the perceived amount of blue in these photographs, was not different as a result of acetaminophen.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
It's Baldwin Way. He's professor of psychology at Ohio State University, and also Jeff Durso. He is a doctoral candidate in psychology at Ohio State University. We've been talking about research they've done on the effect of acetaminophen on people's emotions. We'll have a link to the report on our website at wosu.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In this age of fitness trackers and online insurance exchanges, technology seems to be giving patients more control over their health care. But as hospitals move from paper to digital, both patients and doctors are facing unintended and sometimes dangerous consequences. Joining me now is the director of the Division of Hospital Medicine at UC San Francisco, Robert Wachter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ann.
You're author of the book, The Digital Doctor. When we talk about the transition from analog to digital in terms of healthcare, what do we mean?
Well, up until recently, shockingly, medicine was the one large swath of our economy that was largely analog. Doctors wrote their notes on paper. You know, patients had to get paper bills and call in to make appointments. And really, over the last few years, medicine has gone digital very, very quickly, which is why this is sort of a crucial moment in medicine, because we're getting used to practicing medicine in a new way via computers.
I notice, for instance, if I call up with a question about something that happened in a previous doctor's appointment, they're so much faster to say, here, let me check the record.
Yeah. I mean, the key point that I like to emphasize, the book is largely about the unanticipated consequences and some of the problems with computerization. But I'm not a Luddite. I believe strongly that medicine had to computerize, and we've been looking forward to this moment for a couple of decades. And ultimately, it will be terrific for medicine. I think having your record in one place, being able to share your record has major advantages for patients and for physicians, but it has been a much, much bumpier road than any of us anticipated.
Tell us about some of the biggest bumps in the road.
Well, I think patients feel them when they go and see their doctor. One of my colleagues told me about going to see his doctor, who he liked very much and had seen several times in the past, but this time he went in. And the doctor asked him a question, and as soon as he started to answer, the doctor turned his head down into the laptop and began typing. And then the doctor looked up to ask the next question, and the doctor turned down and started typing again. And I asked him what he did, and he said he found a new doctor. And so that's just one of them. And the fastest growing profession in medicine, believe it or not, is scribes, is doctors hiring young people to feed the computer to essentially be scribes, so that the doctors and patients could make eye contact again, which, of course, is remarkable. Every other industry brings in computers and lays people off. We are seeing those sort of consequences, people paying more attention to the digital version of the patient than the patient. Computers are preventing all kinds of errors, but they're creating new classes of errors, particularly when the alerts fire every couple of seconds, so people just learn to pay no attention to them. Those are the sort of things that we're going through growing pains, and part of it is that the systems are still fairly clunky, and a part of it is that computerization really does transform the nature of the work, and we were naive about that. We believe that you just bring in the computers, turn on the switch, and you just make things better and easier, because I think that's what we're used to with our iPhones. But that's not the way computerization of something as complicated as healthcare works.
I've noticed that in going through a series of appointments with a family member that everybody asks us the same questions over and over and over and over and over again. And I wondered, we just answered somebody and they just plugged it into the computer and you're this big healthcare system. Why do you have to keep asking us? Why? And they said, because we're worried about errors. Is there a greater chance for errors?
Yeah, there probably is, but we are at such an early phase of this that we have chosen to deal with these kinds of issues by each of the providers you see along the way has a screen now in front of him or her, and that prompts them to ask a whole series of questions. And there actually is some benefit in redundancy. So, for example, I will come in and see a patient sometimes, and I have read what the patient said to the nurse or the clerk outside, and I still will re-ask a few of the questions because hearing it from the horse's mouth has some real value for me, but not repeating everything. And part of this is, again, the notion of just computerizing all the processes and you automatically make things better. It just doesn't work that way in healthcare, but we have not gone through the hard work of of saying, that's kind of a wasteful and error-prone process when you're being asked the same thing nine different times. What does the process look like? When you come in and see the go to the doctor's office or go to the emergency room, what does person one ask you? What does person two need to ask you but takes advantage of what you told person one? That isn't really a computer question. That's kind of a workflow and process design question, and I think we're still at the kind of version 1.0 of all this, so we haven't gotten around to improving the processes the way we need to.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the digitalization of healthcare. My guest is Dr. Robert Wachter. He is a professor of the Department of Medicine at UC San Francisco and author of a new book. It's called The Digital Doctor. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 is the number to call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. Post your question or comment there. So when you say that you mentioned, I think as you referred to a friend of yours who went to another doctor because he didn't like not having the eye contact anymore. You also mentioned that doctors are hiring scribes in some cases so that they can do that. So there's equal dissatisfaction or there's dissatisfaction on both sides of the equation.
Oh, absolutely. I think patients are feeling that when they come in and they sometimes sense that the doctor cares more about the computer screen than cares about me. And believe me, the doctors are unhappy about that as well. In fact, probably more unhappy about that than the patients are in many ways. There was an advertisement that I saw and wrote about in my book from an emergency department in a hospital outside of Phoenix last year, advertised for an emergency medicine doctor. And the advertisement went through the usual amenities. We've got radiology department with all the latest tools, and we have nice ORs and all of that. But the final line of the advertisement, and the only one that was in bold, they clearly thought it was their main selling point, was that we have no computers. We have no electronic medical record. You can still, in 2015, write your notes on paper. And that is how they were advertising for a new doctor, just as a piece of evidence of how dissatisfied many doctors are with their current predicament.
Mary in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Robert Wachter. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Hi, welcome. Thank you. I just experienced this with my father. 95, took him to a small family practice, and we lost touch with him as soon as we went into the doctor's or into the patient's room or the exam room. Mm-hmm. He got on his computer and never looked my father in the eye. I mean, rarely. And I finally said to him, look, you know, what are you doing here? My father didn't know what was going on. He's like, gosh, isn't he going to check me out? He just kept on writing, and I do hope that we get back to that one-on-one relationship with our doctors. Thanks for the topic, and I hope a lot of doctors are listening.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Mary. We have to, and some of the answer will be in better technology. Eventually, I think what will happen, and there's some forward-thinking practices that are doing this now, you put the computer screen between the doctor and the patient a little bit off to the side so both of them can look at the screen at the same time. And some places are even going further than that, and the doctor and the patient are really co-creating the note. Eventually, we'll have better voice recognition. So, I can envision a world 5 or 10 years from now where you and I have a conversation and the note magically appears on the computer screen and goes all into the right categories and checks all the right boxes based on what we talked about. That's kind of where we need to be heading. It's important to understand that part of what is happening is the doctors are being forced to record all sorts of information, some of which is really relevant to your care, but some of which is required by the insurance companies, required by people that are measuring the quality of care, required to prevent a malpractice suit. And so when I spent a lot of time in researching my book with the manufacturers of the computer software, I said, why are these screens so clunky and require so much work? They said, it's really not our fault. There are so many people that want information from the doctor that now that can all be forced via the computer screen, whereas it couldn't be in a paper world, that the doctors basically have to do that and the computer systems basically have to require that. So we have to sort of rethink all of those requirements and try to pare them down even as we make the software better.
So part of the Affordable Care Act was a measure to convert all medical records to digital records. How is it supposed to work? We know we're talking about the bumps in the road, but what was the dream scenario?
Well, it's not rocket science. I mean, we're talking about, the arguably the most important field that we have, our health and our health care. We're talking about the most information-laden field. I mean, there are thousands of new articles that come out every week. Nobody can possibly keep up with that. And so the idea was at the final days of the Bush administration and the early days of the Obama administration, they looked at medicine, which had not gone digital on its own, and said, we want to try to help this along. And so they found $30 billion in the stimulus package when the economy went sour to basically promote computerization. And the goals were the perfectly legitimate goals, that this should make care safer, it should make care more efficient. And in many ways it does. I mean, it is important to say that my ability to look at a patient's X-ray from home because it's computerized, or read my colleague's notes because it's no longer in chicken scratch, or someone can read my prescription and make sure that they, you know, that it's not illegible. Those are all wonderful things. And from the standpoint of patient engagement, patients have had a right to look at their chart, their medical record for the last 20 years, but try to go to a hospital that's using paper and say, I'd like to see my chart. Well, that will be 3 weeks, and we'll have to photocopy it. It'll cost you 30 cents a page. Well, now all that a patient needs to see their chart is a password. So there are so many wonderful things. And the federal government, I think, was quite wise to say it's not happening on its own. We want to promote computerization. I think what has surprised all of us is how hard it is, how many bumps along the way there have been. And part of it is because the systems are immature and really have a version 1.0 feel to them. But part of it is that we really underestimated the complexity of the task. We came to believe that this was really just like your iPhone and we could download an app and off you are finding the nearest Starbucks. But this is what's known as an adaptive problem of the highest order. It really is the technology completely transforms the nature of the field, of the doctor-patient relationship, of the way we communicate with each other. And we didn't think that through carefully enough, and that's really what we're going back to the drawing board and doing now, not only making the computer systems better, but reimagining the practice of medicine in a digital world.
Right. We've been talking about the whole bedside manner issue for years now and how doctors are being retrained or trained in medical school to pay more attention to that issue. But now we've got this added factor of the digitalization.
Yeah. And it's not just bedside manner. It's not just us communicating with patients. It's the way we communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you may recall last year, the first case of Ebola, the patient who came to the hospital in Dallas. And the nurse in the triage nurse outside in the ER got the information from the patient that he had a high fever and he'd recently been in Liberia. And she recorded it dutifully in her electronic record. And then the patient was seen by the doctor a few minutes later and didn't look at the nurse's portion because it's under a different tab and didn't ask the same question, sent the patient out, and the patient ultimately died of Ebola. And the hospital blamed the computer system. Well, yes and no. I mean, the computer system wasn't perfect, but the information was in the system. The computer system was to blame in a funny way, and it's because I think in the old days, if the nurse got that information from a patient, that this is a patient who's just back from Liberia and has a high fever, I think she would have tapped the doctor on the shoulder and said, Doc, take a look at, you know, the guy in room four. He's got a high fever. He's just back from Liberia. But these days, there's less shoulder tapping going on because we all have our noses in our computer doing our computer work. This is not dissimilar to your kids not talking to each other when they're at the kitchen table over breakfast. But in our world, you know, it's that face-to-face communication, the personal communication, the tapping on the shoulder, that has gone away. And so it's compromised not just our interactions with patients, but to some extent our interactions with each other.
Zach in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Zach.
Hi, thanks for having me on here.
You bet.
I know a nurse practitioner who said, she's been doing this for about 10 years, she said that since her hospital has gone digital, they have been scheduling her more patients, actually quite a bit more. She said she went from seeing 30 to 40 a day to sometimes as much as 60. And what it's expected of her that she should be able to chart quicker. I was just wondering if this is a common problem, because what she is experiencing is she's having to chart after she gets done seeing patients for the day, and she's really worried that she's going to forget some very crucial information. So I wonder if that's a common problem or whether that's just maybe unique to this hospital, that sort of thing.
That's interesting. Dr. Robert Wachter?
Yeah. one of the hopes of computerization was that it would make everybody more efficient, because if you think about it, our computers have generally made us more efficient in most of the things that we do. That has not been the experience of most places, and if anything, in many outpatient practices, they've actually had to slow down the number of patients they see. It's not that the computer is inherently inefficient, but it is easier and faster to scribble down your recollection of a visit or write while you're talking to the patient at the same time. And now that it's computerized, what people find is they've got to click a box and click a box and go to another screen and toggle back and forth between screens. And again, part of that is the computer systems are pretty mature and need to get better. And part of it is the requirements of the extra work that we're asking of nurse practitioners and doctors. And it's a little bit of just one more thing syndrome. You know that syndrome from when you remodel your house. Mm-hmm. It's like, just one more thing. Now that we're putting in a computer system, why don't we ask the nurse practitioner just record this extra thing? Well, there are about 50 just one more things. And by the time you're done, people are spending that much more time with their head down on the computer. So I have not heard places expecting their folks to see more patients. If anything, people are realizing that they can't see the same number of patients until the systems get better. And that's not just the software. That's the way we sort of think about the way work happens.
Zach, thanks a lot for that call. We have an email from Lou, who writes, there is a serious issue with healthcare and interoperability between different computer systems, systems that don't talk to each other. Providers and consumers don't understand how hard it is to get the systems to pass info back and forth. I think this issue will take a very long time to correct because everybody's system is different. Your guest makes it sound like it's a simple fix, and it's not.
Oh, I hope I haven't made it sound
I read that. I don't think you've made it sound like a simple fix.
No, it's extraordinarily hard, Lou. I'm sorry if I gave that impression. Let me just spend a moment talking about interoperability. So interoperability is why I can put my Bank of America card in a Citibank machine and get $100 out. So in the banking system, we have figured out a way that all these systems talk to each other. And it turns out to be really easy in banking. Not trivially easy, they had to work on it, but defining what the $20 transaction is in a banking system and making sure you can debit one bank's account when you put your card in another bank's machine is not that hard to do. Getting different computer systems to talk to each other in medicine is orders of magnitude harder than that. And right now, they don't do it very well. It is probably the biggest issue in the digitalization of healthcare. Up until the last 5 years, the issue was just to get us to use computers. And we have gone from about 10% computerization in doctors' offices and hospitals 5 years ago to 70 or 75% today. So we really have become a digital field over the last 5 years. And the new issue that everybody is working on is how do you now get these computers to talk to each other? It's hard to do. You have to create standards so that the same language in each computer sort of talks to each other. There's some business issues. If you're a big computer vendor, you actually don't particularly want your machine to talk to other machines because you want everybody to buy your software. So the federal government has to be involved and sort of knock some heads together and make it happen. But there's a lot of pressure to make it happen. If we can make it happen, the world becomes a better place in ways that are obvious and other ways that are a little bit more subtle. The obvious way is if you go to see a doctor out of your network or you are in a car accident and go to an emergency room out of your system, they can see your record. That's fabulous. The less obvious way is if all the systems talk to each other and somebody in Silicon Valley develops some fabulous new app that can augment your hospital's computer system, making it easy for that app to bolt onto your computer system and share data with the data that's already in there, really creates a much more vibrant and innovative market for computerization. So there's a lot of good reasons why this has to happen, but I have a chapter or two in my book on it. It's really, really hard to do. I think we'll get there, but it's probably going to be 5 to 7 years.
Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Dr. Robert Wachter. He is a professor in the Department of Medicine at UC San Francisco, and he's the author of a new book. It's called The Digital Doctor. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Almost no role carries with it more hopes, more expectations, and more baggage than motherhood. But as many as 1 in 7 new moms experience some form of postpartum depression, as it's known, and many of them are too afraid to seek help. A new play from Mental Health America of Franklin County hopes to destigmatize the ups and downs of motherhood. Joining us now in the studio for more is the director of the Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms at Mental Health America of Franklin County, Tanya Fullwider. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
And also with us is Becca Alexander. She's a mentor and volunteer with the Perinatal Outreach Program. Welcome to the show, Becca.
Thank you.
And one of the actors from the show and a health coach herself, Melissa Muguruza. Welcome back, Melissa.
Thank you so much.
You've been putting on a great show called Momologues. We've talked about it before. I think for 3 years you did that, right?
Yes.
Momologues. And that was a show, a play written by some women in Boston.
Correct.
And that went over real well until it became a little dated sometimes.
Yes. Yeah. And we did all the renditions of it.
Right.
All three different plays.
Right. Mm-hmm. So now you've created your own entertainment, because it is entertainment.
Yes.
It's called Give Mom the Mic, Tales from the Motherhood. And for listeners, if you're interested in attending this performance, it's May 1st at the McCoy Center in Hilliard. Check the website at WOSU.org for more information. So what's new or different about this production, Tanya Fullwider?
Well, it's written, produced, created all locally. So the stories are derived from hundreds of submissions that local moms have sent to us over the last several months. And then we have a talented writer and a talented cast and crew who have brought this to life. We've compiled all the stories. We've created 4 characters, very similar to the Momologues, but given them some different aspects to them. But it's all local.
Melissa Muguruza, you've been with all 4 productions now. What do you think is the biggest difference in how the motherhood is treated in Give Mom the Mic?
I think the best part about this is that it is the stories from the local moms. These are women who are right here in our own backyards, who are having the same issues we're having, who struggle for support, who want to be validated, who all want to connect. And we know that being a mom is a hard job, and sometimes it's made a lot easier when we can reach out to other moms. So I think the best part about it is that these are our stories.
How did you get the stories?
So we compiled the stories by having these little sessions where we would come together and there would be a question thrown out. I believe that you actually led one mm-hmm. of those sessions also where, you know, we would say, here's the topic, let's talk. So, you know, we would throw out questions and the moms would just start telling their stories. And that was the best part.
Mm-hmm. And some of them were written contributions?
Correct. We did online submissions. So several prompts, tell me about a time when, I think failure. Talk about what's that mean to you and those kinds of things. So it was both online and then we did the hosted roundtable conversations. And the content was just so rich and deep and I think cathartic even for some women in that process to tell that story.
I think when I moderated one of those discussions, you or someone else in your organization said that this is depthful as a lot of your group conversations are at POM.
Yes. Yes. That I had talked about that, you know, women come to our support group and they often feel broken and alone. And the conversations we hosted weren't support groups. These were just women getting together talking. And some of the issues were one and the same.
Right. I guess, Becca, the question is, how do we distinguish between feeling blue, that full-on depression that's associated with motherhood, early motherhood particularly?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for the line being blurred between what is considered baby blues and what is considered postpartum depression or anxiety. And I think because it presents itself in a variety of different ways, ways in which we don't expect and ways in which the media doesn't educate us to expect. I think that probably the best way to determine that is to talk to other moms. And that's kind of the way that most of us have figured out that this is an issue that needs to be treated for us and that we're not alone.
Well, we're all good at talking to each other all the time. But what is it about motherhood that sometimes there's a disconnect there?
I think, especially in the media recently, there's been this aspect of what people are talking about, the mommy wars and competition. And moms are afraid to feel as if their peers might think they're not measuring up. And so I feel like there's a lot of fear there that makes moms not want to reach out, makes them not want to tell people what they're feeling. And even, you know, people didn't used to talk about this sort of thing all the time. It was just kind of one of those things that fell in and out, and you just dealt with it. And I think that it's definitely something that needs to be addressed specifically.
Yeah, the mommy wars is an aspect of the new show.
It sure is. Yeah, we do touch on that. And I think that more often than not, mothers do want to come together. They do want to connect. They want to find commonalities. But there are those times that are kind of trying where we do feel judged or ostracized for choices that we make or things that our kids do that are completely out of our control.
And one of the issues that came up in the conversation that I was involved in and moderated was the fear part. You know, I kind of said fear. And everyone said what their fears were. And I was amazed at these incredible people who said, I'm afraid that my kid's going to turn out like me.
Yes. I mean, it's everything. Looking at who you are and what your own life looks like and your illnesses and genetics. And what if I pass that on? And that realization doesn't always come to fruition until you start to see your child grow.
So much an age of too much information, Becca Alexander.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Yes.
How do you, in your the groups that you lead, as people you mentor, how do you get them to open up and talk about these issues in a way that's helpful and productive?
I think the number one thing that is extremely helpful and was helpful for me when I was going through this as well was listening. Just being an ear for those women to express things that they wouldn't want to express elsewhere. And I feel like once you listen to them and you're able to validate and qualify their experiences, they start to feel less alone. And I think feeling alone is really exacerbates the symptoms that you experience during that time so much. So I think getting them to open up is just listening to them and letting them talk and offering them your experiences where it's appropriate and really allowing them to just feel and feel like that it's okay to feel the way they feel.
Tanya Fullwilder, you've been doing this for how many years now?
Poem's been around for about 11 years.
And I was wondering how much of the issues changed over the course of a decade or so?
Some things are exactly the same. The feeling of alone, the feeling that I must be the only one, I must be crazy, I'm ruining my child. Those things are still the same. What's changed? The way we communicate, the way we connect, the amount of information we have access to.
The too much information problem, perhaps.
Yeah.
The social media, another issue.
Yes.
Good and
that's
bad.
And that's exactly. It's good and bad. It's great that we have so many ways to connect with each other, but we also have so many ways to find out, oh gosh, maybe I'm not doing this right, or maybe I should think about this, or this expert says this thing and this expert says that thing. And where we could, you know, we used to just be able to access that in the library, and now it's, you know, texting and blogging and, you know, with each other, and there's just so many things coming at moms at once.
And when you started Poem, it wasn't part of Mental Health America of Franklin County, but Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms was independent because there wasn't anything else out there like it.
Right. The co-founder and I, Amy Burt and I, we were part of this small little grassroots support group, and we knew it helped us so much, but we're just two moms. We had no clinical medical, you know, knowledge whatsoever, but we said we have to do something. So we started our own thing, and then it's grown, and now, again, we're part of Mental Health America.
And it's a career for you.
Correct.
Right.
Yes.
Melissa, you're going to act in this again. This will be
I
your
am.
fourth year? Have you acted every year?
I have acted every year.
You've directed, too.
I have.
And you're not this year, though.
I am not. No, I have a wonderful, wonderful friend and also mother who's stepping in to direct.
How do you how does a good story play out in terms of balance and pain and joy?
Right. So one of the things that makes watching people on stage interesting is seeing energy, right? We want to see energy on stage. That's why we go. And seeing somebody fighting against an emotion is so much more interesting than just crying or just laughing. So there's a lot of push-pull underneath the text that the women are reading that give it the depth that you would experience in those everyday conversations with your girlfriends and moms.
And I think a fun part of it is going to be that there are local landmarks referred to instead of Bostonian landmarks. It's local.
Right.
And that makes a difference. So tell us about what this night's supposed to kind of be like, Tanya Fulwider. What is it like? It's fourth year now. It's the second year at McCoy Center. Or third
second
year.
Second or third, yes. Okay. So it's a fun mom's night out, girls' night out. Lots of mother daughters, girlfriends come and
book clubs.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely. It's connecting. Part of what made us start this in the first place is because we realized how important it is for women to connect authentically. So they'll laugh. Maybe they'll cry. They'll definitely find something, many things to relate to in the script, no matter what stage of motherhood they're in, whether brand new or have grandbabies, and just have fun and celebrate the crazy journey that is motherhood.
I think last year I met a grandmother, mother, daughter group. So three generations were there at the same time. And which helps explain and helps them understand more how much they have in common, even though their generations are very different. So it's a fundraiser for Mental Health America of Franklin County.
Mm-hmm. For right? the POEM program.
For the POEM program. Uh-huh. That's the Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms at Mental Health America of Franklin County. I'll be the MC for the program. It's on May 1st, the weekend before Mother's Day weekend.
Correct.
Right? Mm-hmm. So hopefully if you want to check this out, do so. There's a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want more information. For tickets are how much now?
$35 individually.
Very affordable. Or groups at a lower rate?
No. Groups are the same rate, but tables are reserved.
Gotcha. Okay. And thank you so much for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And Becca Alexander, what else is going on at the event besides the show?
Oh, there's also raffles.
Yes.
There will be, I think those have been donated by local mm-hmm. businesses, and that raffle also generates a lot of donations for POEM.
Yes.
And I think Tanya probably knows more too.
It's cash bar, raffle, and then the play and
the good old reliable cash bar.
That's right.
Well, I want to thank you, Becca Alexander. You're a mentor and volunteer with the POEM program. Thanks for joining us today. And Tanya Fulwider, as usual, one of these years, I'll remember how to pronounce your name, Director of the Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms at Mental Health America of Franklin County. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Ann.
And also Melissa Muguruza, actor in Give Mom the Mic, also a well-known actor in the Central Ohio area and a health coach herself. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, the All Sides interns Michael Hepburn, Shahina Sagiri, Hannah Palmer, Abdul Rahman Al-Ruweishan, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.